This is Speaking of Faith's Unheard Cut. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Giza LeWeb. She's a professor of religious studies who talked with me about her experience caring for her mother who had Alzheimer's. I spoke with her on September 17, 2004, from the studios of American Public Media in St. Paul, Minnesota. She was in the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our conversation is featured online as part of our program, Alzheimer's, Memory, and Being. Download the MP3 of the produced show at speakingoffaith.org.
Well, it's nice to meet you this way.
Nice to meet you. I wish I could see you.
I know. Well, I actually find that this kind of conversation can be very intimate because, as in the experience of faith, you're not too distracted by what you can or cannot see.
Yeah.
So just close your eyes and I'll come straight into your thoughts.
Okay. I think I have to keep one eye open so I can see if the engineer needs to talk to me.
Krista, I need a little bit more level from you.
You need more level.
Yes, I do.
Well, let me tell you, I want to tell you something personal, actually, before we get going. I don't know if this was mentioned, but I'm very interested in this subject. I spent some time when I was at divinity school as a chaplain on an Alzheimer's ward. Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly important to me. So, you know, I made some of my own observations. Now I'm hearing a big echo.
Uh-oh.
Let me just listen.
Turn down the headphones. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, we're working on it.
How's that?
Let me keep talking and see. I don't hear it
now. Okay.
Anyway, I wasn't in there. Well, I'm still hearing a slight echo. Mitch, do you hear it? No. I wasn't in there with the emotional attachment and the grief of a family member. Uh-huh. But in some ways, what was quite wonderful was I got to know people exactly as they were then. You know, I wasn't comparing them against the person I remembered.
Right.
And I found that to be a great gift, actually, and just being there for them and sort of loving them the way I encountered them. And anyway, I think this essay of yours is remarkable, and so I want to get into it. And
I can't hear you. I don't hear her now.
Bring up your headphones a moment.
Bring up my headphones?
No, turn the volume up.
Okay.
Now I'm...
Well, I just turned it back up.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right. Now I hear that slight echo
again. But now
again.
The echo... Now she hears the echo again. He's running between the booths.
Okay. What changed when I went away for you? Do you know?
I unplugged a couple of headphones.
Oh, okay. Okay. Do you have any questions about the program or what we're doing?
No, I guess I'll play it a little bit by ear. I think my only question is, do you want me to try and be real brief in my answers, or would you like me to just say what's on my mind and you edit it the way you need to, or some combination?
We have a wonderful luxury in this program because we do get to have a real conversation and we edit it later. So I don't want you to worry about how long you are.
Okay.
And it really is a conversation rather than questions and answers.
Okay.
Now I've got the echo again, Mitch. Okay. we will work this out. This is a perfect kind of topic and approach for us. We did a program on the subject of depression, which also touches so many people's lives, and tried to get at, you know, what is the spiritual aspect of depression. That's something, even though we talk so much about it, and I think it's similar with Alzheimer's. We talk in terms of psychology and medicine and biology and even the social issues, but not... what do we learn through this experience about the essence of what it means to be human, partly by what goes away?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, Mitch is on the phone. I'm just...
Still more. Okay. Yeah.
Is there anything I can do?
Just, is that enough or more? Turn it down more?
No. Could you turn it down a little bit more?
Okay. How's that?
Let me keep that. I think that's fine. I think we've got there. Are you all right? Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay.
Yes. All right. Indeed.
All right.
Okay.
I am curious about your religious background. You you are yeah. steeped in so many traditions. mm-hmm. And I ask this question of just about everyone I interview. Mm-hmm. What is your mm-hmm. tradition?
Yeah. My kinship is most with Catholicism. I grew up as a Roman Catholic and had no bad nun stories. So I didn't have a kind of experiential reason to move away and be interested in other religions. I think I came to the field of world religions because actually of a deep feeling of spirituality that came through my Catholic background. I think that my parents, especially my mother, instilled that spirituality, but I think I was protected from some of the negative aspects that I hear about in people's experience and know from history. Mm-hmm. But because my parents were in the military and we moved and we traveled a lot, so the one continuity in terms of every time we picked up and went somewhere, which was always a loss, was the ritual of the Mass. My mom lighting candles, and those things were very meaningful to me. Other coincidences, a spiritual mentor, an 84-year-old woman who lived next door to us when I was about 8 years old. And she was an artist, she was a painter, she was a very spiritual woman, and I used to go over there and spend a lot of time listening to her stories and her own spiritual journey, and she influenced me a lot. I only knew her for 3 years, but that 84-year-old woman had a tremendous impact through her sharing her own vision, which was very open. Her mother was Catholic. Her father was Episcopalian. And she was an artist who was, just a very wonderful person.
I'm curious, mm-hmm, how you came to be focusing especially on Islamic mysticism.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I have found that I am not alone in this. I have found that there are Catholics who have been very much influenced by Islamic thought, especially the mystical dimension. I think the kind of specific entry was when my husband and I were married, and here was my first interreligious encounter. We married and we were different religions, which was in those days in 1969 in El Paso, Texas. A Catholic marrying a Baptist was bad for both sides. And also there were a lot of social problems we were feeling. There was a certain amount of social criticism going on, a lot of it. We were concerned about the war. We were concerned about civil rights and the part that religions played in the bad side of things as well as the good side. So as a result of our trying to sort out what we wanted to hold together as a vision of unity and respect for people of different religions and so forth, we again stumbled across a spiritual group that was from Indonesia, Indonesia's Muslim, mostly 95% of the people are Muslim there, yeah. But Islam came through the Sufis who came as traders, and so the type of Islam that has permeated Indonesia, at least until very recently, has had this mystical strand. And in that time of the early 70s in the United States, there were teachers coming from the East, and one right. that particularly struck us was one who spoke about the unity of religions, the heart of all religions as being the same. And that it was not a call to leave anybody's religion. That's the thing that really got us. It was a call to think about an inner core that we shared. And so that was the entry. And so I came to have Muslim friends as well as Christian and Buddhist friends and Jewish friends in this organization. So that was the beginning. And then I wanted to search the more cultural and theological aspects. The kind of praying with people made me want to study the outer forms more. So it took me into the field.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This article that you wrote about your experience with your mother's Alzheimer's disease, did you write that for Cross Currents?
No. I actually wrote it as a paper for the American Academy of Religion, a version of it, that is. It was my first time of trying to write about Alzheimer's, and it was really risky trying to put this forward to an academic community. But that was the beginning, and there was a panel on alternative ideas in health and spirituality. And although I usually am doing papers in the Islamic section or Islamic mysticism section, I did it, and that was the beginning. And then the editor at that time was at that meeting, and he asked if I would contribute.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, it was not him, but before.
Right.
Yeah, it was before that. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you know, I wonder if I want to to get into a lot of the ideas and stories that you tell in that, but I wonder if you would start by sort of telling me, as a story, about your mother's illness and how you came to start to be experiencing that as having a spiritual dimension and started making religious observations of that experience. Mm-hmm. Can you remember first moments when you started to connect these things?
Well, as I mentioned in the article, she was the whole process from beginning when she came to live with us, and we could see the demise starting till and then through her going to the nursing home. It was in the before she went to the nursing home, which was her last 6 years. I started feeling that. That was the time when I realized there wasn't too much information out there on this subject, and I would try to go to meetings at academic situations, and I just didn't find. I found religious traditions just talking about their line, what to do in terms of, if you're Catholic, receiving the sacraments or not, or nursing homes being religiously affiliated and how you take care of patients who, are various religions. But what I was needing was guidance on how to think about my own reactions to my mother's decline. And that included, those feelings of loss and grieving that people mention, but there's also that negative aspect, or natural aspect, I should say, where frustration, not knowing what to do with one's own feelings of anger and frustration. If you've said something to someone for the second time, it's really okay. The 50th time, you really are not sure what to do. And so what to try to change in a person, what to try to hold on to, what to accept, how to accept it, that was the kind of beginnings of the, exploring kind of what the implications are.
Now, say something. I know what you're describing about that grief and that frustration because I worked in this with Alzheimer's patients. But I think people who haven't been through this, really take me inside that, what that is to be living with your mother who is suffering from this particular disease.
Yeah. Well, when I look back, I seem to remember the more humorous side of it. But if you understand that the humor is now, and at the time it could be so pretty frustrating, since the memory is going, but long-term memory is there, short-term memory goes, the habits that the person has are still there. So I just give you for example, she was living with us and perfectly mobile and able to get around and knowing what to do and washing. She really contributed to the family and washing dishes and washing clothes. But she sometimes, I mean, what happened was eventually she would forget how many times, for example, she had washed the clothes. And you could, you know, no matter what you said, the clothes were going to get washed 5 times a day. And you could put a note on the washing machine at one stage, and that would alert her. But at the later the next stage, and this is incremental, but it's really one function after another. After a while, there's a forgetfulness to read the notes, or reading the notes and forgetting what it said. So you see, you know, things can get pretty crazy in a household, and the terrible decision. What to do about it, and whether to put your loved one in a nursing home. That becomes a really big issue, it becomes a matter of a kind of a craziness in the household, a kind of an insanity that you can cope with for a long time. But eventually, at least for me, it was when safety factors were really there, and my mother began wandering and trying to find a situation that would work for us when I was at school teaching. I teach in northern New Jersey, which is 2 hours from my home, and between, it just was not workable to be able to watch her and keep her safe.
I think you make some important observations about what goes away in a person who is suffering from Alzheimer's disease and what stays. I mean, talk to me about how you observed that.
Well, what goes away, again, it's incremental, but it begins with just things that in a way are not so important. I think, you know, what somebody said the last thing, but you know, what somebody just said a few minutes ago. But what goes away in terms of judgment, as I said, that's another level going, just even really the remembrance of a door that you see ahead of you. So that, you know, that's an issue. But also in terms of remembering one's place in time and space goes away too. And certain other kinds of boundaries like privacy and shame. So I'll tell you a couple of those. The boundaries of time, the most common aspect that people really feel upset about is when you are forgotten. What goes away is their memory of their place in time. And so you may not be the person that when they look at you, they don't know who you are. And so people feel great sadness when they're not recognized. And I speak about that as something that we really have to think about and deal with, what that means to feel.
And take that seriously, right?
Yeah. You know, that, and trying to bring that person back to the present. There's also a very disconcerting situations that happen because of, again, that loss of time and space. Of there's a thing called projection that, you know, they project someone else on you, and that has kind of consequences also. Boundaries of things that are normal in terms of issues of privacy and things that you learn. For example, a perfectly respectable, almost shy person. That was my mom. But when she, at a certain point, she could not remember that, or she never thought that it was inappropriate to just go into other people's rooms and take their clothes and put them on. And at one point, she was even kind of a ringleader of taking a few other women who were about at the same stage that she was, and they would go down the hall and just take clothes out of other people's closets and put them on themselves. And there was nothing you could do about that because... I mean, the nurses were very good. They had the same observation that I did that I had actually observed before she went to the nursing home, that you can't say no, because no, even though they can hear it and they understand no, but they won't remember. It's more of a feeling that they can still have of no, more than the concept of what the no is about. So the word no is a useless concept. And it, in fact, it's a dangerous concept because it's or action, because it seems to leave a very strong impression of negativity or sadness or upsetness, and it's really clearly visible, and it lasts even though the event, the simple no, don't do that, is long gone, but this goes away. And my sense is that was of real concern to me, because I realized that she was a person in this state. Their sense of time is altered. For all I knew, mm-hmm. she might be experiencing that negative feeling for years from her point. You know what I mean? The mm-hmm. sense of time is altered. Who knows what it felt like? So you have to really think about other ways of communicating. And again, what things not to care about. So one thing is, don't care about anything physical, like clothes or anything. You just do. But, you know, how do you manage that in a institutional situation or at home? It's not easy. And I really, really have a lot of respect for the ways that good nursing home facilities try to work with these things.
And it was in that. Yes, I'm sorry. Okay. Do you have some? Do you have a cup of water there? Mitch is saying, could you take a drink of water? Mm-hmm. All right. So along these lines of communication with your mm-hmm. mother, this was one of these places mm-hmm. where you made this very interesting connection, where you said mm-hmm. you found for yourself a resource mm-hmm. in the Buddhist idea of right or compassionate speech.
Yeah.
And Zen or original mind. Yeah. Now tell me about that.
Yes. Yeah.
First of all, what do you mean when you use mm-hmm. that term, right? Okay. Compassionate speech.
Yeah. If there are three major aspects of spirituality that I felt I could really adopt for thinking about Alzheimer's, it was in Buddhism, the idea of right speech, and some ideas from Islamic thought as well as Catholic thought, and I can talk about those later.
Yeah, we'll get to others. Yeah,
but the right speech, as I understand it, or compassionate speech, is not simply an issue of telling the truth. It's compassionate speech, or right speech, is speech that does not create violence. And violence, of course, it can come in many forms. And so that example I gave before of saying no, or that's a bad thing, that's a form of violence in a way to a person who has lost the sense of judgment or the capacity to change. So the example that I remember most of understanding what that meant was a time when my daughter and I were visiting my mother, and she asked us about her mother. She said, "How is Tata?" That's how she called her mother. Mm. And I said to her, and I knew I had a sense that I should be careful about saying that she was not alive anymore, but I carefully said, "Well, you know, Mom, she died, right?" And she had this look on her face that it was the first time she had heard this. Hmm. And my daughter saw it. These things are really visible things that you can see, and it made me very sad that I had caused an unnecessary unhappiness. Again, as I said, it lasts. I mean, why Why does she need to know that? Again, I'm thinking that that's my own need for, we have this need to be heard in a certain way. We need structures to be proper. We need her to remember the proper history.
You're
of
sort of bringing her back to reality, right?
Yeah, our reality, right. My reality, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I think of that as unnecessary.
That's also about how you mentioned that Alzheimer's sort of dislocates people in time and space. And the truth is that, and you write about this as well, that a person with Alzheimer's disease, they don't really just remember things. They sometimes are very much reliving moments of their lives. So what you're describing, you may have actually broken the news to your mother of her own mother's death again.
That's what I felt. That's what I felt like I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
But you also make this, you say that you came to believe that it was possible. Mm. That it's very important how you are present with someone, knowing that. Mm. And then you even use this term, time travel therapy.
Yeah, that's... I hope that phrase doesn't turn people off, but...
Well, what do you mean?
Okay, well, this is my thought. Again, this is based just on observations, so it does seem that... You can, if you pay attention to a person's speech, even though it doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of its time or the people in it, you can, and oftentimes, and people with family members who have Alzheimer's recognize this, you see loops of behavior. You see the same story coming back around again, and a certain kind of upsetness that comes around again. You can see that something is really a problem, but you can't really ask about it. I mean, you can ask if you can help, you can ask what's wrong, and kind of enter into their story wherever it is. I think that in my experience when I did this with my mom or with other Alzheimer's patients that were where she was, they seemed to really respond so positively to just having somebody listen and tell their rant. Mm-hmm. And when they felt an affirmation, when one affirms it of them, then they seem to... You see a certain peace or resolution or something, and my feeling is that you're seeing some processing going on through these kind of kinds of behavior. And so my sense is that if their time is altered and if they're somewhere else reliving or working on some past pain, past hurt or sadness, that to hear it and enter in could possibly... help in a kind of healing, a kind of resolution, knowing that it is temporary, because that will go also, but it's at least mm-hmm. the moment, yeah, mm-hmm. the memory of what was said, what you say may be forgotten, mm-hmm. and that feeling of momentary peace may be forgotten, but it was a moment of peace. And again, we don't know what that means in terms of their time framework.
Can you tell me a story of mm-hmm. when this happened with your mother or with someone else?
Well, I remember one that comes to mind is a time when we were... this is interesting because in a way it's my mother helping another patient. we were walking down the hall and there was a woman who clearly saw my mother as someone else and said to her, "Oh, Elizabeth, how are you? I hear you've had so much, you know, you're here and you know, you've had so many troubles and it's so good." You know, it was very loving to my mom, and my mom just accepted it. They had this communication that my mother really just accepted whatever it was that the other woman said, and my mother absorbed it, and it was a kind of a gift to her as well. Mm. Yeah. And I saw also people who clearly had some deep trauma that was coming up. Sometimes it was feeling left by their children, but sometimes it seemed much deeper, seeming like maybe some kind of violent thing that happened to them. And it really seemed to help to hold their hand, to listen and to look them in the eye, and to offer some kind of peace or resolution. Because I can't say for sure that it has some
therapeutic effect.
Therapeutic effect.
Yeah, yeah.
It has a temporary effect. And again, because of this issue of time and the mind with Alzheimer's, I feel that it is at least a momentary healing and something worth doing.
Yeah. I remember that also from my experiences that and there would be particular people who seemed, I mean, there was one woman I knew who just seemed to have been plunged back into a terrible childhood,
mm-hmm.
a terrible experience with her father.
Mm-hmm.
And the
mm-hmm.
trauma, yeah. The drama of that was, but she was, yes. She was acting it out. I mean, it was with
yes.
us.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm. I think we see that a lot. I'm not sure if that's part of what another thing that we see that even has a name, because the people who take care of Alzheimer's patients even have a name for it. It's called sundowning. Mm-hmm. People with Alzheimer's go through a stage where they cry at sundown. It's when the sun goes down. And sometimes it seems that they're sad about a specific thing. That they're grieving over a specific thing. And it may be something that happened to them, but I also felt that what we might be seeing was some kind of deep feeling of loss within themselves, about themselves. It seemed too coincidental that it was at sundown that this happened, and somehow the idea of the twilight of one's life somehow being manifest in the soul, you know, it made me feel that there is some deep spiritual recognition and natural grieving at that.
So you write, I want to read this. It's a mm-hmm. very beautiful, you said that you felt, not only in your mother, but in the other people she was with mm-hmm. who had Alzheimer's, that you were gaining a glimpse of inner lives, of their inner lives. And mm-hmm. you write, mm-hmm. and I also felt that. I felt mm-hmm. that even mm-hmm. though I was meeting these people as they were, often mm-hmm. in mid or late stages of Alzheimer's, so I mm-hmm. could not learn the facts of their life, right?
Right, right.
I could not learn who they were, what kind mm-hmm. of the usual things that we present in
yes.
In our reality to the ways we present ourselves to other people with our credentials
yes.
and our history.
Yes.
All of
yes.
that was gone. And the facade,
right.
even the physical facade, here they were, whatever kind of life they lived, they were living in this home. Okay.
Yep.
But
yep.
I felt mm-hmm. like I could know something about the kind of life they'd lived and whether they had
yes.
been a happy person or a sad person or a good
yes.
person or a bad
yes.
person, right? And so
yes.
you wrote, this
yes.
is very validating
mm-hmm.
for you, you said,
mm-hmm.
I have wondered and I'm ready to propose it as a theory if mm-hmm. what is seen in these glimpses is a sort of crystallization of the sum total of a life,
mm-hmm.
its qualities, mm-hmm. the inner heavens and hells created in life mm-hmm. prior to the point at which it is no longer consciously possible to will a resolution or change in the experience being lived out in the timeless realm of the Alzheimer's patient.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, that's... what can I say? That really summarizes it. I mean... my sense is that I really had to do a lot of reflecting on that. If that is what we are seeing, the question in my mind was, first, what can we know about that person and how does that help them? What we can do to help them? But it also made me very conscious. This was one of the spiritual realizations that I feel very strongly about. I think that Alzheimer's really, if that's true, if we have crystallized at that moment and we cannot go back because we don't have the choice in our consciousness to go back, then it really seems to indicate that we should be prepared to die. We need to look towards death not in a morbid way, but the reality that we should live each life, each day in life, as if it were our last, and in preparation for a time that we may not have the sense of awareness to be able to do a kind of conscious healing, no more therapies, but...
or even to mask or control.
That's right.
Whatever we have to regret, which is what we do.
That's right. And that was, that was what I... the part of Islamic mysticism that influenced me in that thinking, the experience reminded me of this term that is used by the Sufis called "die before you die," which simply means that you have an awareness that you hope you can have an awareness of the truth of your life. That when you die, you will. That's one thing. That I was interested in the ideas of afterlife in Islam, and one thing that struck me about ideas in afterlife in the Islamic religion, especially in the Sufi tradition, was that you are conscious of what you have done in your life. You really do know. Maybe for the first time, you actually see things as they were, truly and clearly. So it's not that you have to be punished by someone else. You actually understand the suffering that you created, and you understand the joy that you created and the love that you created. So the goal in this life, then, is to try to live in a way that we can experience things as they are, with that kind of clarity. And so my sense is that if one lives that way, then God willing, that's the way that if we can't choose anymore, that we'll have those inner qualities embedded in a way that will be manifest.
Mm-hmm. So, as you say, this is something that you can't prove, that none of us can prove, but let's say, did you experience, so you knew your mother, you knew her entire life. I mean, would you say the way she wore her Alzheimer's, the way she lived through that to the end, did you continue to see the core of the person you had known through the disease?
I think so. I think that in the earlier stages, when she was weeping and doing kind of crazy things, like I mentioned about taking other people's clothes and putting them on and putting them off, and those things were not like her.
Right. So you have to separate out what's the illness and what's the personality.
Yeah. So I kind of accept that, but in the later stages, when it was more difficult to communicate, when speech was gone, for example, I felt that there's not a way I can prove this, but I felt very clearly that I could see things in her eyes, that I could see a certain feeling that I tried to follow. And for example, usually she had she just had this certain compassionate look in her eyes. Everybody had said that about her. So you could tell if she was worried or frustrated about something and not in that kind of peaceful state. And the first time I actually took action on it was my feeling that she was trying to tell me something. She had a look in her eyes that was feeling that she felt disturbed in her inner being. And I actually asked about medication. Mm-hmm. My feeling was that she was not feeling good, just at that level. And I looked into it, and we altered her medication.
You mean that you felt that the medication was getting in the way?
for yeah, her.
Yeah,
exactly.
I want to ask you. I
think she was upset about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's not hard to over-medicate someone, because if they were going through that period, for example, of sundowning, mm-hmm. and it's normal to give some kind of antidepressants or sedatives or something, but if it's easy, since the person can't communicate with you, that unless you have some advocate there, they could be over-medicated or maybe not need that medicine anymore, because that medicine was for that stage. Mm-hmm. And the normal policy is that you don't change the medication unless you need to. And how would a person know that she needed it changed? I mean, it clearly helped in the calming down in the disturbing parts of
unless
her
there's someone
experience.
Like you who could read her eyes.
Yeah, that's right. But other things for example, on the level of remembering the joys of her life, she loved her family so much, so having pictures, simple thing of having particular images of people that she was very close to, especially if I knew that she was sort of in the experience of about 1940. I didn't mention that, but there is this thing that you can see that a person is kind of moving back in time. At least some people's experience is that. So I could tell my mother was no longer in 1960 or 50, but about 1940. Mm. And I tried to have images of people that she loved. And at that point, and also because she was calling them by name, cousins and things, you know, long dead. And when I put certain pictures in her room, and it was at a time when she was quite ill, she looked at them and she recognized them and she changed. And some of these things, I have to say, I would call a nurse in to verify. Am I just seeing this? No, you know. And they would see it too. You could see it in the eyes. My daughters could see it in the eyes. So I think that I could see a lot of what was there. And even in some of the very final stages when she was unconscious, there were certain things that she loved all through her life, and part of it was her Catholic spirituality and the sacraments. And she grew up during the time of the Latin Mass and going to novenas, which are prayers, reciting the rosary. And so I thought that perhaps bringing in some sacred music at least in my mind, had the feeling of that era. And I brought in some of the music of Hildegard, the woman mystic.
Hildegard of Bingen.
Of Bingen, mm-hmm. Yes. And that particular time, when I was using that music, it was a time when she wasn't even opening her eyes, and you could see that she heard it by her body, the breathing, and it was such a clear change that happened that the nurses took note of it, and they when I wasn't there, they were playing the music too. even earlier stages when it was when she seemed to be appreciating things, let's say in the 1940s or something, and big band music, she would just love it. She would love the music of her era.
And I believe it is also very much across the board true that the last thing that often goes for people verbally is the ability to recite from religious rituals, prayers, mm-hmm. and music.
Yeah.
How do you explain that with all of your perspective on this?
Well, my perspective is that the formulas of religion, even the prayers, and especially the creeds, with the statements of belief, if they're not internalized by this time, they're not so useful. I think that my sense is that language goes, and in my mind, prayers and creedal statements are, grasping for
a
word
here. Have they become more deeply rooted than language, though?
I think they have. And so I think that if there's a way to get at the deep-rooted, I want to use the word essence of it, mm-hmm. is the way to go. And I think that there are ways to do that if we recognize, and I feel this is my experience and my observation, I think that there is an inner dimension, the same inner dimension that you could see through the eyes. There's something in there, and there's something that apprehends, I'll use that term, there's something that apprehends something of reality in a very deep way that is not dependent on, it's not the specifics of the words, but something of the essence. So the music or the feeling of the prayer, partly because of probably their having recited it, it has to be, you know, getting at the essence of it. I think that one of the things that disturbed me in when I was looking for, in the early days of my approaching this subject, when I was looking for people in religious positions, priests or ministers or even academics who give papers on theology, I would go to meetings trying to find some discussion on religion and Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And what I heard was not satisfying to me. It didn't make sense in my experience. There was, for example, I remember hearing discussion of whether a person should be able to receive the sacraments if they're not mentally mentally normal.
Right.
And that really struck me. Why is that so? I have to admit that I had there were times when I would see my mom and the other people who were about in her generation Catholic, and I said, there needs to be a priest here, and if you can't get a priest, get someone dressed like a priest, because you know they really. The experience of communion, for example, is very deep. And so when the discussions were on the theological issue of whether a person should receive communion or not, they were not satisfying approaches. And also approaches, I've talked to some pastoral counselors at nursing homes who have had some experiences of feeling uncomfortable with when a nursing home is of a particular religious affiliation, mm-hmm. that there is an opportunity to use a person who has Alzheimer's as someone who could be saved, you know, mm-hmm. and to me, again, that's really not what the issues should be at the in this particular kind of demise of Alzheimer's. I think the person, you know, you want to find is that beautiful human being in there that maybe needs some help and encouragement in this incremental dying.
You know, you are a scholar of religion, and it sort of surprises me that you don't use the word soul. I mean, is that what you're talking about when you describe
yes.
this something that you can still see in someone's eyes?
You know what? You're right. I think that the reason I haven't used it so much is because I'm in academia, but truly, that's what it means.
Okay.
I think you are seeing something there that that by its very nature apprehends things without the necessity of linear thinking.
And also this the importance of nonverbal communication and just presence, right? Of you've talked
yes.
about eye contact, touch, when words are no
Absolutely.
Longer possible or very meaningful.
Yeah.
And I wonder how have you reflected on that religiously, or how did your knowledge of religious traditions flow into the way you made sense of what that means?
Could you just repeat that one more time?
Yeah, this whole nonverbal realm that becomes mm-hmm. ever more important when mm-hmm. being with a person with Alzheimer's.
Right.
Eye contact and touch. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, how did you, what kinds of religious or spiritual observations mm-hmm. did you make out of that experience? Mm-hmm. And also, how did you understand it, maybe because mm-hmm. of your knowledge mm-hmm. of religious traditions?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'll say again, I know that I can't prove any of this, but my sense is that there are a number of truths from different religions that merge on this point, that the spiritual realm is something that is experienced. Yeah, we have the body in this life, but it's something much deeper and can still be touched literally through using the sensual, but not with the kind of expectations that we usually have to the results of our actions. Hmm. But you do see something happen with the touch, and also with the other forms of other senses. For example, hearing, the way you speak. There's something in the essence of how one speaks to a person. Again, the example that I gave of the of saying no, mm-hmm. You know, that's a way. It's touching the soul in a way that is that causes pain, that causes harm. But the what I think of as the sacramental aspect of life and of religion, I feel that it's probably inherited. Probably, my sense of that comes through my Catholic background, because if there's one thing that I remember growing up with was a very deep, deep sense of connection that was experienced through things like mm-hmm. the smell of incense or hearing chanting or hugging. I have Latin background, and literally the sense of touch as healing and really feeling as a human being. Right. So, I think that from my perspective, those things could be brought to the Alzheimer's patient through one's own communication that comes through, again, not necessarily in a linear fashion, but through affirmations of the person's, you know, you listen to them and affirm what they're saying, to touching them, holding their hand, to presenting them with aural hearing, you know, things mm-hmm. that you know that they would love to hear. Smelling things. I'm feeling that even as subtle as that would be important. I know that there are a few nursing homes that use animals. Yes. I know this would have been an amazing, amazing joy for my mother. I know, and actually there are studies, I think, on this subject, how being able to stroke a pet or, mm-hmm. Having a pet or having birds to look at gives people an inner joy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to explain that, except that there's something in the soul that has a connection with the spiritual world and can be that can be actualized.
And there's also this dualism between spirit and body that I think a lot of modern people are rejecting. And in fact, as you're saying, in sacrament religious traditions, mm-hmm. bring the two together. And I mean, you even use this phrase body memory. You said in Alzheimer's that you become aware.
Yes.
I mean, it's always the body is, the memory is no longer in words and intellect, but it's still there and physically.
Yeah. You can see it. You have a body memory, and I think that's why rituals are important. Body language. My mother's last independent action before she really could not get around by herself anymore was to walk to Mass, to walk to a noon Mass in our neighborhood. And she was at a stage where she was really not making sense in terms of time, or, you know, she was almost at the point where she was wandering. Obviously, she knew how to get to the church. It was a block away. But she remembered the candles. She remembered kneeling. She remembered the motions of the prayers. And I know that she had a great sense of peace. The body memory was there.
It strikes me also that there's something in the way you're describing this that evokes a religious sensibility about time, which also is never so linear. That the past and the present and the future are somehow all much more obviously connected.
I feel myself I need to do some more thinking about how they relate, because I know there are a lot of theories about it, but again, trying to base it on my experience, it's I have the sense that there is this thing, I think, that has been labeled the eternal, because you see it in the again, let's go back to my mother's experience of seeing a different person as she was looking at me. There's a stage where sometimes they project onto you. So it's clearly they are somewhere else. They are in that time. So I don't know exactly what time is, but she is present to that moment. And then the ability to, on one hand, that you can't, on this side of it, on the caretaker's side, you can't try to bring it back. That's what I was saying before. So there is a sense in which time, is a reality that has to be contended with. But at the same time, you can enter into it. That the issue of time traveling, I don't know what other way to put it, because it does feel that you are entering into a... you're entering into a dimension that can be moved through. I don't have the words for it, but that you can enter in. Clearly, that doesn't make sense in a certain way, unless you're going the speed of light or something. I think you get young or something. Yeah. But you see the reality of having gotten there, if you want to put it that way, or being there, and. I what can I make of it except to say that there's something that transcends time that can be experienced?
This really gets at also the difference that between someone who is, for very understandable reasons, sitting with someone who doesn't remember them anymore, who is not living in the present in reality, and finding that incredibly painful and frustrating, and struggling against that. I mean, sort of what you just described to me is incredibly exciting and adventurous, right?
I mean,
there's incredible grief going on for you too. But could you really have that sense of adventure even when your mother was in the midst of this long dying?
It's true. Well, going back to the idea of compassionate speech, where I would try to enter into wherever she was, even parentheses, I had a discussion with this with a priest once. Even lying, even not telling the truth on this side of the spectrum, but creating a story about her mother, I didn't do it at that time, but
when you she's dead.
Well, I would never do that again. Any other situation that was near that, I could talk about, you know, what they're doing. I just heard from them. You know, I could create worlds. I never felt so liberated.
Right.
I mean, it was kind of taking on a role. And it was because it was creating a kind of a world that could be and that would be enjoyed by her. So, it seemed the right thing to do. It seemed the right thing.
I wonder, it sounds like your mother was a person who had lived, who'd done a lot of right things in her life. I mean, that you said she had a compassionate look in her eyes when that's all that was left. I wonder if you have known people or seen people who lived through this disease with people who had a lot of regrets or a lot of just pain that was left over at the end of their lives and how that was different for them.
Well, if you're asking about the person who has Alzheimer's, who has lived a life of a lot of pain, I felt there were a number of patients that I saw that seemed to be the case, because I continued to, when I would come back to visit my mother, they perhaps were in that same kind of state, that upset state. I agree with what you're saying. I found my sense was that, you know, the sad reality is that a lot of people have a lot of pain in their lives and we don't know why. And whether it's self-caused or things that happen to them, they're experiencing, again, going back to the essence of it, they're experiencing a negative feeling that there's not a way for them to move out of it consciously. And so that's because of that reality, that's part of why I came to feel that part of the learning for the caretaker and people in caretaking situations is to see that as an opportunity to help in a kind of healing. But that will only work if the caretaker has the that sense, again, it's kind of from the Buddhist thought of compassionate speech, that you're not needing something from it. You have to let go of outcomes.
That the caretaker doesn't need an outcome to
exactly.
Okay.
Which has consequences. My sense is that in some cases caretakers don't caretake because they don't see outcomes. In fact, after I gave a talk at a nursing home once, and one of the head nurses said, "You know, I think that that's true. I think that if nurses felt that they had that what they were doing had significance, even though it didn't have a predictable or hoped for outcome, that they were doing something of meaning, that it would help in better caretaking." But so that's why the process of looking at the type of illness at Alzheimer's is, it really could be help us reflect on our own spiritual growth.
That's also, I mean, it's a spiritual discipline, isn't it? I'm thinking of Thomas Merton writing about pure intention, which is to do the right thing and completely suspend control over what the impact of that thing is.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You can see the immediate piece usually. I know that there are cases where somebody is really, really upset, and people have to resort, probably in caretaking situations where there needs to be some kind of order and stability. I don't refute the idea of needing medication sometimes, but I think in general, if there's somebody to move through with people on these at these kind of crisis moments, then I think it's beneficial to both, even if it's momentary.
You need somebody rather than medicating that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is a hard thing to talk about too, because in some ways the spiritual dimension that you have experienced in Alzheimer's as a caretaker and in watching your mother suggests that we would need to be very careful about medicating Mm-hmm. I mean, if these moments even of pain and crisis that people who are sort of moving through time experience are mm-hmm. occasions for possible healing, mm-hmm. then, I mean, then mm-hmm. that really says something about how serious mm-hmm. it is to give someone mm-hmm. a pill that is going to take it away or knock them out.
That's right. I think that issue needs to be looked at very carefully. I don't want to, in the experience where my mother was, I felt that it was probably pretty typical, that it's probably necessary sometimes. There's such a mm-hmm. overload of work that the people have to do, and sometimes that seems the best thing, and to give some kind of antidepressants.
And sometimes it's a matter of physically restraining people, too, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I had to deal with that with my mother, too. You know, what would be worse, for her to walk down the hall or to be kind of running around wild? mm-hmm. But, you know, it gets very difficult sometimes because, as I said, when the memory goes of not seeing the door that you saw a second ago, you do slam into the door, and my mother did slam into the door, and I came in to see her one day, and she was very bruised. But I know you have to have a certain trust in how things are going in the nursing decisions, but it's really important to be an advocate and to be that person have someone who is looking at the whole person, mm-hmm. and looking for clues, you know, like their eyes and the medication. You know, I would hope if I were in this situation that I would not be given medication except as a last resort, which could be an important, you know, mm-hmm. very important. It's kind of like natural childbirth, you know. it's actually a common situation. I remember with my first child that it was a time when you just accepted medication. This was in 69. The doctors were still just routinely giving medication and to help speed the, to help calm the, I don't know what they did, but at any rate, I went into labor and I was fine for a long time with a nurse who was talking me through the stages, and that nurse went off duty, and another nurse came and said, wait a minute, you're supposed to have some medication by now, and you know, the kind of medication put me into a kind of I could not think clearly mm-hmm. anymore. Mm-hmm. So my feeling is medication should really be carefully thought through.
Well, it's an interesting analogy, too, since at one point you described the what happens to a person in Alzheimer's as sort of moving backwards towards the womb in some ways in terms of their personality.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's true. That was a feeling partly because of the time that they seemed to be in, the kind of the names of people they mentioned. Also because of that sense that they were working through experiences. Mm-hmm.
We need to finish, and I just, you know, mm-hmm. you make one very significant, you come out in a, sorry, excuse me, here I can use this. You come out in a, with some religious conclusions. I'm sorry. You come out of this experience of your mother's Alzheimer's disease with some religious conclusions, also as a scholar of many religions, that seemed mm-hmm. to me quite dramatic and fascinating, that you said that the nature of Alzheimer's decline suggests both the reality of the radical impermanence of life, mm-hmm. Which is represented very much at the heart of Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And then also, you say, also at the same time, you had such a strong mm-hmm. sense of the reality of some deeper knowing/knower.
Yeah.
Talk to me about holding those two religious worldviews together.
Well, I see, I have to hold them together. That's why I, as an academic, you know, if I were a theologian, those two... trying to hold two different theological perspectives like that would be, you know, I would be a heretic. But fortunately, as an academic, and not just as an academic, that's the thing here, why I wrote this, because in my experience, I have come to see that somehow these two views are both true. It makes me reflect on issues of, you know, conflict between religions, which I see all the time, and why people need to hold so much to one particular theological interpretation of things when you see the realities that seem to indicate that it's a much wider way. There are much broader and wider ways of holding together truth. So it forces me to feel that the religions that have helped me to who gave insight to areas of the kinds of experience that Alzheimer's presents, they are gifts of kinds of understanding that are, they're gifts to humankind.
Can you put some words around what it is about this condition of Alzheimer's disease, though, that gave you a lens through which to bring these very, as you say, these conflicting worldviews together? What is it that suggests that it's a very powerful experience and transcendent experience almost?
I agree. It may not be the same way for everyone who's dealing with someone who has Alzheimer's. The situation with my mother was incremental in the way it happened over, you know, from early stages to late stages. And you could see the stages clearly. There were kind of like dips. She'd be on one plateau for a while and then almost dramatically at times, a next level. And so for me, it was an opportunity in my time frameworks on this side of the line to observe and to try to adjust and to try and understand what I could understand from her and what I should do, what I ought to do, what would be the best thing to do. So it's almost like there was a little bit of time in these stages, and then the fact that the Alzheimer's experience is so bound up, but the problematic side of it is so bound up with time, time and ego. The ego exists in time, and the sense of self is rooted in time. And so my sense is that the thing that's most challenging spiritually about dealing with Alzheimer's is that because of their lack of time orientation, they don't recognize our self. They don't recognize the self of the other. And but it's partly because they don't have a sense of their own place in time as we normally understand it. So the reflection on time, and so the capacity of memory and what happens when that capacity changes or diminishes, what is still there? I have been very influenced by thinking about these things through some of the works of Oliver Sacks, who, if I can think, the names of his books are always evocative. One of them is The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, or The Anthropologist on Mars. Well, if I remember one thing that I got out of his work, was something that I'm sure I remember because I saw it in my mother, that something, he worked on brain damage, you know, when there's a certain part of the brain that doesn't work. What is the capacity of the person? What is their capacity for living a full life? And so that's the thing. You know that scientifically, in the brain, why now we even know what's happening in the brain with Alzheimer's patient. The Nunn study is a wonderful study of what happens to the brain and what is diminished. But at the same time, as Oliver Sacks pointed out, and as you can see with Alzheimer's, that there are other worlds. There are other worlds of experience that one can find, one can discover.
That remain intact.
Aside from that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that seems to indicate that the experience is not bound to time. So,
which for you points towards what is beyond time.
That's right.
You said that, the eternal a while ago.
Absolutely. The eternal in the now. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is also that kind of emphasis is also rooted in religious traditions, in Buddhism, that mindfulness,
yes.
I guess, of the present.
That's right. I think that the reason why I hold together with the Buddhist sense of mind as impermanent, many insights that Buddhism has on this issue, but I also hold together with it that aspect of the importance of the sacramental is because there is that connection of the infinite and the finite. The finite seems to be a tool that can open up those worlds.
Hmm. Mitch, can we have a couple more minutes or do we need to finish? We need to finish. Yeah? Couple more minutes? This is what I. Okay, this is me being a little bit self-indulgent, but I just want to talk to you about a couple of other things. I just want to in terms of an experience I had, not only that, and again, I was so privileged to be working with be meeting Alzheimer's patients where they were living then, so I didn't have the grief of a family member.
Yes.
But
yes.
I also felt that, in some sense, they are stripped of all the credentials by which we present ourselves to each other.
Yes.
But then
yes.
The other thing that they demand of you, which is really spiritually demanding, I mean, they're not impressed either by your resume, right?
That's
or
right.
How intelligent
exactly.
you are, or how well-spoken,
right.
or how you
That's
present
right.
yourself, or what you look like.
Mm-hmm.
But that in some ways, the only things they would, that they could respond to and would respond mm-hmm. to would mm-hmm. be mm-hmm. would be qualities of kindness, compassion.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Good patience.
That's right.
And and attention to the present.
That's right. See, that's what really matters. that's it.
I mean, that is mm-hmm. quite amazing that you walk into this sphere of illness and that's
yes.
what's called for if you are going to if there's any point in you being there.
That's right. And just to, you know, because I'm, you know, part of me is the academic, you know, I think that what you just said needs to be emphasized because there's so much emphasis on how we can't understand things unless we are coming at things with knowledge of the culture or the time period or whatever, you know. it's as if we can't understand another human being without knowing all those finite dimensions. And that's what you do see. That does, the Alzheimer's experience shows what is really real, you know, through even in this diminished state, those capacities for experiencing patience, compassion, sensitivity, joy.
Yeah,
you know, they go through. You might as you know if you could speak them, you know, but you don't have to many
no,
times.
No, right. That's where that touch and eye contact comes
mm-hmm,
in more.
Mm-hmm. And how something is said more than what is said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah. And the other thing is a story, and this is a way in which a religious images and ideas and songs can also be fixed in people in destructive ways, in the way that religion itself can be destructive.
Yeah.
There was once a woman I met, she's 92, she had Alzheimer's, and she saw this badge that I had that said chaplain, and she said, oh, you're a chaplain. I used to go to church all the time, every Sunday, and they made me sing. Do you want to hear a song? And I said, sure, sing it. So she sang, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Little ones to him belong, for he is right and they are wrong.
Whoa.
Right? And the real words are what?
Yes.
For
he is weak.
They are weak and he is strong. But, you know, I thought, you know, that's sort of the way I remember hearing that song when I was a kid, too. But I felt like this was huge, right?
Can you imagine? You see, things aren't in kind of a mathematical proportion.
Yeah.
The way that people experience things is not in proportion to some kind of objective description or truth. It's how they experience it, and that goes into the body memory, and that goes into the feelings that can be tapped into, as you found out.
And that's also then with Alzheimer's, it's all out on the surface, right?
That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, and better, let's know what kinds of music make you feel good inside, and make sure your children know them.
So that you can give that to the nurses later.
Exactly.
Oh, well, this has been really lovely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are we okay? I think we need to finish. And
okay. Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's good to have this conversation with you. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you too.
Okay. Bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Thanks again, Julian.